I'm really happy to be here. I can't believe how many faces are out there. It's a bit daunting. So no, I won't. I'll stay. Look, I know in your programs you've got about 28 slides of mine, and you probably looked at them and went, oh no, death by PowerPoint. Truth is, I can talk underwater with a mouthful of marbles for absolute hours without taking a breath, but there's no way I can do a presentation on slides. So you're saved. You can take it home and read it, and there's phone numbers on there for you, so if there's any questions, come to Bravehearts and we'll answer them. What I'm going to try and do is present it in a different way that's probably a little bit more, well, hopefully you can relate to it a little better. And that is to tell you a little of my story. There's three slides, in fact, in my presentation. I ditched the slides the last Generation Next. By the way, congratulations to the organisers. This is an amazing day. And it's just so much fun, and the speakers are incredible. So congratulations, and thank you for the opportunity. Now, I'm just a little bit of history, because I don't know how many of you actually know about Bravehearts or how it started, but I'm a very ordinary person. I'll tell you the story about how it started, because this could happen to absolutely any one of you in this room. This isn't unique to me or to any other individual. This just happens. This thing called child sexual assault. My parents are immigrants. I'm born in Victoria, very normal, very, you know, middle class life, really, nothing spectacular. I met the man of my dreams, and we've lived together in New Zealand, and we lived together in Perth, and we live together currently still here in Queensland. Life was buzzing along beautifully. I'm an accountant, so I was running national companies. We were making lots of money, we're going water skiing. We were living the dream. We were certainly living the dream. And then I fell pregnant with our daughter, something they said would never happen for me. And so it was very exciting for both my husband and I. So I quit work for 2 years to stay home and to be with this child and to watch all of those beautiful things, just to enjoy this child. And of course, a person like me gets very bored very quickly. I'm annoying because I just can't do nothing. It's just not possible for me. So whilst I was so enjoying this experience, it's still the best part of my life. It was just the most beautiful experience. I needed more. So when she was sleeping, I was like, all right, what now? What am I going to do now? What am I going to do now? And I got myself a little bit interested in a campaign that was running at the time about running a toll road through Australia's largest remaining koala habitat in Daisy Hill. I don't know how many of you remember that, but I got myself involved in that just really out of boredom to begin with. That's what it was. It was my husband's, his fault, because he said to me, go along and put your name down on the piece of paper. And I went, really? Now, I come from a background of people, surprisingly, who don't donate anything. My parents are Dutch, and that says it all, doesn't it? Truly. And they were actually really annoyed with me for having the audacity to donate my time. What are you doing? Doing something for nothing? You're donating your time? You're volunteering? It's really quite amazing. But it was my husband's fault. He said to do it. The thing is, I believe that things happen for a reason. And so my involvement in that campaign exposed me to all kinds of different things that I'd never been exposed to before. It taught me so much about people. It taught me about, you know, how to motivate people to change. It taught me about politics. It taught me about terms of references. It taught me about environmental issues. And most importantly, it taught me about myself. And surprise, surprise, I don't mind a little bit of argy-bargy. I don't mind having a debate. I don't mind taking it up to those that try to do us over, so to speak. So what happened in that campaign is that there was a government promise not to build a road. We all voted. And then after the election, they changed their mind and they were going to build this road. Unfortunately, there were thousands of us that took objection to that. In that process, I learned about writing press releases. My first speech was to 7,000 people, and I was so cranky I didn't even know anyone was there. I was just going off. Oh, dear. And so that's my nature. That's who I am, you know. I just knew it was wrong. So We won that campaign, and the then leader of the Australian Democrats, Cheryl Curnow, asked me to come and work for her, and I said no, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be a politician, so eventually I did, and I became the state leader of the Australian Democrats in Queensland. And it was 90, and I did that because I was really interested in keeping the bastards honest. That was my motivation for the Democrats. I hope that didn't offend anybody, but you know what? Hey, just have a look at what we just looked at, talk about. Right, so things have changed. That used to offend people. They used to write in and complain about that, those words. It's incredible. So in that role as state leader, I learned a lot about politics. I learned more about politics, more about writing speeches. I represented Cheryl at this and that. I spent time with her in Canberra. I started to learn a little bit about Senate politics. Now, this was all happening, I believe, for a reason. I was getting exposure to all of this for a reason. So I had the business background, I had the state sort of element, and the campaigning. I learned from some of the very best campaigners, environmental campaigners. And now I'm getting exposure to the federal sphere. And it's 1996 and the federal election's on, and I say to my husband, why don't you take our daughter and go and visit your family in New Zealand? So I can do what I do, what I love to do, which is just put the blinkers on and just go hard. And I was running as a candidate in the seat of Fadden. Now, you don't do that to win if you're a Democrat. That's not going to happen, okay. We know that before you even start. They're obviously no longer a political party for really good reasons. But at the time, this was all very real for me. So I just said to... And it was to support the senators. It wasn't to get elected. So off he goes to New Zealand. We're at the airport, at the international airport. The lifts, the things are going down. Everyone, have you all been to the airport and the... escalators or whatever they're called are going down, and he's got Kayleen, my husband, and he's holding her, so she's looking that way, and I'm at the top and I'm saying bye, and she's just screaming, mommy, mommy, mommy. And I thought, gee, you know when your kids make a certain noise that's over and above just whinging, you know, when you know that is something wrong. I had a sense of that as she was leaving the airport. So I said to Ian, ring me. Ring me when you get downstairs and let me know she's all right and when you get to New Zealand. So he did that. He said she's fine. She'd settled down. Everything was good. So I go home. They're off to New Zealand and I go back to my work. Now, when they get to New Zealand, the whole family has come around to welcome the prodigal son home. So, you know, there's all the family and the Ugg boots and all the rest of it. Yep, in the lounge room of the home, and they're all having a really, really good time. And my husband, Ian, notices that our daughter is sort of, where is she? She's gone a lot. And Poppy, his father, is also gone a lot. And he says he noticed it, but he didn't really think anything too much about it. And then later on in the evening, it was time for bed, and he said to Kayleen, Kayleen, it's time to go to bed. She doesn't mind me using her name, by the way. Silence is not one of our family's greatest attributes. And so he said, it's time for you to go to bed. Now, she was only six, nearly seven, just a little thing. And she went off her... Because Poppy had made her own room. So normally she would sleep with us. This time, because she was a big girl now, she had her own room and apparently was all pink and pretty and very, very lovely. But she wasn't going. She had no intention of going into that room. And so, you know, that same shrill, upset sound. Look, if I'm upsetting anybody, please feel free to I'm sorry, number one, but just leave. I'll try not to do that. We'll skip past this quickly. But I think I can talk to you about indicators, and I can talk to you about, you know, outcomes, and I can do all that dry stuff, but this is real. And this can happen and does happen, can happen to any one of you, and I'm sure has to some of you. But it can happen to any one of us at any time. So I just feel like this is the better way to tell you the story. So she was crying. She was really upset, hysterical. She did not want to go into that bedroom. So Ian grabbed her and he said, don't worry, you don't have to go in there. You come sleep with Daddy. You come and lie down on Daddy's bed, it's all right. And he's lying, he's patting her, and she's What's wrong? I'm scared. What are you scared of? I'm scared of Poppy. And at this point, my husband says his heart just jumped into his throat. Why are you scared of Poppy? Because Poppy touches me. Where does Poppy touch you? Sure as eggs. And at that split second, my husband's life shattered into a zillion pieces. His mother died when he was young. His dad was everything. We both had him on a pedestal. We had businesses with him in New Zealand, here in Australia. Absolutely worshipped the man. And is to this day, beyond me, I cannot see both of those people in the same human being. So I understand when people like Bill Cosby go up and people go, no way, that can't happen. Rolf Harris, get out of here, don't be ridiculous. Alex Johnston, never, no way, yes way. So my husband's lying there with his frightened, trembling little girl, and he pats her and he calms her and he says, don't, and he's breaking. Don't worry, I will protect you. I won't let him near you. So he lies with her until she's asleep. And then out in the lounge room, while all this is going on, there are all these people partying, having a great time. So he goes out and says to them, look, I'm not feeling well. I'm sure he said it differently than that. You can imagine. Get out, I'm tired. No, didn't do that either. He would have gone, I don't know, I wasn't there. But he went out and said, you know, I don't feel well, I'm going to head off to bed soon. And everyone sort of got the idea and sort of disappeared early. He waited, went to bed, waited for everybody to go to sleep and then did the rounds of the house to make sure everyone that was there was actually asleep. And then he left the home and he went up to the street, up the main street, and did a bit of damage to some public property just out of anger. Went into a phone box and rang me. Now, I was at home. I was working. It was about 11 p.m. at night. And the phone rings. I'm thinking, this is really odd. And I pick up the phone. And I've got Ian on the other end, just indiscernible, saying, Kayleen, Popper. Kayleen or Poppy. I'm thinking, oh, and there's been an accident. There's a car accident. Something's happened. You know, are they all right? And you get, yes. I'm thinking, well, what are you ringing me for? What's going on? Kayleen, Poppy. And then he just screamed out, he sexually assaulted her. And I was like, then it was my turn to just be totally numb. I can't even begin to explain it to you. It's a trust issue. So, you know, when you hear that trust is a big issue, particularly for people who've been harmed as children, and in our case I'm talking about child sexual assault, that's the first casualty is trust. It is so true. But it's not just true for the survivor themselves, it is true for everyone connected. I just thought, if I can't trust this man, who can I trust? If I can't trust Alex with our daughter, well, who do I trust? It means I can't trust anybody. And I didn't know what to do, because you know what? I thought in my nice little white picket fence world, this didn't happen. I didn't even really know what it was. I mean, I knew what it was, but I didn't ever imagine, you know, I didn't give it any thought. I just never imagined that anything like that could affect people like us. That's how ignorant and naive that I was. So I sat there in stunned silence, and then the neighbours came over, and some of them are GPs. So I said to them, just give me some tablets. Just give me some tablets and knock me out, because I couldn't be in my head. I just couldn't. I didn't know what to do. And for someone like me, that's really odd, you know, because I think, like most of you, you're pretty resourceful, aren't you? You can sort of get around most things. You might get a bit of a shock, but you think, okay, well, this is what we're going to do. But in this case, I was totally taken. The whole thing was gone. Looking through a kaleidoscope, you done that? There's no top, there's no bottom, logical, right? There's no left, there's no right, there's no stability. Everything's moving. Nothing is still, nothing. You can't grab a hold of anything, because the moment you try, it moves, right? That's what it's like. Well, that's how it felt for me. It's the best way that I can describe it. So the doctors, my mates from up the road, just gave me a couple of tablets. I went and said, that'll knock you out till the morning. And I thought, you beauty. That's what I need. I just can't think. I can't operate. And my head was going to just explode. But it only worked for a couple of hours and I woke up. So it's about 2 or 3 in the morning and I got on the net. What was the net that back? This is 20 years ago. This is 1996. So she was a bit of a clunker back then. I was in my top bedroom and I got up there and I put in child sexual abuse, as it was then sort of often, I call it assault. There's no privilege here that's been abused. This is a crime. This is child sexual assault. It's an assault on a child. It's a crime against a child, right? So, but child sexual abuse. Who does this? Why do they do it? Why didn't I see it? Oh my God, I'm a failure. I'm a failure as a parent because I didn't protect my child. All this stuff going on. Looking at this, who does it? Well, it could be anybody. Okay, got that. What happens to these kids? Suicide. Failure to complete their education. Caitlin was quite clever. Well, she is quite a clever girl. Failure to complete suicide. Drug and alcohol abuse, mental health disorders, depression, anxiety, you name it. The list is endless. Sexual confusion, sexual dysfunction, anger, DV, right? Angry people. Filling our jails and our mental health institutions. While me, absolutely, totally oblivious to the plight of these people. Because you couldn't say the words. We weren't, back in 1996, we weren't even talking about it. So I'm looking at my computer terminal and I'm just feeling sick. Because this is my precious baby. This is the child that Ian and I managed to have that they said we would never have. And all of these things are lined up in front of my eyes and I'm just thinking, no way. How could this happen? This cannot happen to her. So the next, and then I'm looking and I'm thinking, you know, 1 in 5, or back then it was rated 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 8 boys. So that's 1 in 6. And more recently we're understanding it's 1 in 5, so it should be getting better. It's actually not yet, but we are getting there. The good thing about child sexual assault, have to say this, is that it is preventable. That's the beautiful thing about working in this space, is that there is a solution. We just, all of us, have to choose to make it a priority, and we all of us have to choose to be a part of the solution instead of part of the problem. By the way, and I need to say this because quite often I get to the end of this and I've forgotten to say it, our daughter is now 27. She's got her own property. She's going off to Europe shortly. She works at Bravehearts and she's as passionate about it as we are, and she's fully functional adult. So there is hope. It doesn't mean that if you are harmed in this way, that your life is just forever devastated. Very, very fully functional options are available to you if you choose to take them. And if the people around you choose to help you make the right decisions and support you and love you, and that's really the basis of it. So after some reading and panicking, I had the Senate paper, which I was in the middle of, remember, the election. And I was going through writing all these organisations down that I was going to ring the moment business hours started, because I needed to know what to do. I had no idea what to do. There was nothing there saying, do this, don't do that. Nothing. 1996, nothing. So I'm ringing these agencies the next morning, and I've still got this piece of paper. Australian Story have got copies of it. There's an Australian Story out there somewhere, if anyone's interested. And I wrote all these names down. And then when the sun came up, I actually picked up the phone and started trying to ring these numbers, and nobody could help me, I promise you. In this country, nobody could help me. It was the Wellington Rape Crisis Centre that actually was able to talk to me and tell me what I should do and what I shouldn't do. What I should do, believe the child. Tell her that we believe her, of course we do. Tell her that we will keep her safe as much as we can, of course we will. And just love her and keep her safe and keep her warm and feeling. And tell her it's not her fault. All of those things that are on our website and in your resources. I hope that if they're not, they're on our website. That immediate response, you should all know, actually, because you're all at the coalface of this, even if it isn't your own children. The people in this room are the most important people almost. You probably spend more time, awake hours, with these children, particularly the teaching fraternity, than their parents do. And you're certainly listening and communicating with them more, not through malice, but just through, that's just the way it is. So your involvement in this issue is incredibly important. So I looked at all this, rang all these numbers, there was nothing there. I couldn't get an answer. I got an answer. We got Ian home. Turned out Alex Johnston, just to cut this story short because I'm rambling on a bit, as usual. See what I mean? I just go off on a tangent. I rang Ian and I said to him, I'm going to create a story to get you back here, because the advice that we got was that we had to get her out of New Zealand. We weren't to tell anybody in New Zealand, because if we did, the Spanish Inquisition would take over and everyone would start blaming Kayleen and what happened and that whole questioning thing, which she really didn't need. So we rang up and I said, Dad, my father was very ill and he needed to come home immediately. So we got them on a plane, got them back home. I rang the airport. As soon as that plane was in the air, I rang everybody I knew in New Zealand and told them what had happened. Because by the morning, I knew, after looking at the information online, that there is rarely one, these offenders rarely commit offences against one child, or just once. Okay, this is a repetitive behaviour, and I'm thinking about all the kids that he has access to because he's so loved. He's a town Santa. It's a town with Whakatane, or they say it Whakatane, but I'm not swearing, I promise, in New Zealand. And he was a town Santa in there for 10 years. So, you know, I'm thinking, oh, God. And sure as eggs, he was convicted. He had been sexually offending against every female member of that family, only the girls, two generations, mothers and daughters. And not one of those victims, now some are now survivors, ever told each other or anyone else. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. And I was angry in the beginning. I thought, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you warn me? Why did you let our daughter spend time with this man? You knew he was a sex offender. And then the more research I did and the more I started looking into it, the more I began to understand the strength and the power of this silence that surrounds this issue. And I understood absolutely why they didn't say anything, because we wouldn't have believed them, probably. Well, I think I might have, but hindsight's a wonderful thing. I don't know. They felt that he was so powerful as a individual in that little town, and so powerful as a matriarch in the family, that they would ostracise themselves if they told, number one. Number two, so number one, they didn't think they'd be believed. Number two, and very powerfully, they all thought they were the only one. He had made them feel very special. This is common, and that they were the only one. Of course, they were not the only one. And if you're sitting in this audience thinking you're the only one, and it's happened to you, you're not. I can almost guarantee you. So my first mission, I suppose, was to get them back. We did our counselling, and I tried to get on with my life, but I just couldn't get past the fact that one in five of our children are sexually assaulted before they turn 18. And I knew that, and I had the wherewithal to actually do something about it. And I also believe that everything that we do, whether it's this microphone, everything is about energy. It's all just energy, right? And I had this energy of grief and anger and all of these things going on in me. And I had to do something with it, because otherwise I knew, and I can tell you now, it would have killed me. Would have just destroyed me. So I had to do something positive with this. I couldn't just get on with my life and ignore. I was living in Daisy Hill. I'm looking over at Woodridge and Logan. I didn't have to look at Woodridge and Logan, by the way. That was happening in everywhere. It happens in every nook and cranny across this country. But I'm looking over there and I'm thinking, they can't afford, we could afford the $100 a week each that it took to do the counselling. What about these people over here? And what about their children? What are they going to do? There is no support service for these kids. There is no resources for the parents who want to protect their kids. Nothing. So we started Bravehearts. And Ian and I put our energy and our everything into it. We spent a lot of money, about $1 million of our own money, establishing this organisation and ran it for the first 9 years without any government support, because we didn't want government support, because we didn't want the muzzle that came with it. We needed to be able to say what needed to be said without being told, if you say that again, I'll take your funding, or that breaches this, or that breaches that. In fact, I can tell you, we were the first organisation, this is Anna Bligh, to her credit, first organisation in Queensland to get funding without that muzzle clause, because it wouldn't take it. Really, really important, because when I first started talking about child sexual assault and forums like this, not as big as this, because this issue back then especially was like a, it was like if you went into a room, it was like walking into a dark room, cockroach infested, and flicking the light on. Everyone was gone. Nobody wanted to hear it. You couldn't say the words. Back then, this just wouldn't happen because people were not ready to hear the words. In fact, it was illegal to say the words, because when I was speaking, as I am now, that was illegal because it was leading to the identity of my child, which is, of course, against the law. So that was the first law we changed, that's Section 189 of the Child Protection Act. And I remember distinctly walking into the room and saying to them this. It was a big meeting. All the media, they all had to leave all their cameras and stuff outside. And I was terrified, I have to say. I'm not often intimidated, but I was terrified at that meeting because I knew that they were out to get me. And they were. It didn't work. But at one point, I remember sitting on the chair, looking at the door and thinking, I think I might, do I, you know. No, stay, have courage. It takes courage to fight this stuff. So I stayed there and they all told me what a bad mother I was, because in speaking about my family, even though I never named my daughter, I never did, but people that knew us knew it, of course. And if you're, anyway, too much, I could go on about that subject for 3 hours on its own. But I said to them, I am not going to tell my daughter, shh, don't tell anybody. No way. Because the moment I do that, and the moment I do that to myself or to my husband or to anyone else, I'm going to tie a ball and chain around their ankle that tells them that they've got a secret. That somehow or other, they've got this secret they're going to drag around for the rest of their life. They're going to drag the three S's around. Silence, secrecy, and shame. Pedophile's best friend and our kid's worst enemy. And I tell you, there is no way that I don't care. I said to them, and I stand by it today, throw me in jail, I don't care. I will never stop talking about this. I am proud of my daughter. Because when she spoke, all those other kids stopped getting sexually assaulted as well. We were living in Australia, so she wasn't even as exposed as they were. That's probably part of the reason she spoke up, because it was not normal for her. But for the kids in New Zealand, it was quite normal. Am I going to tell her to be quiet? Because that's how we dealt with it. Culturally, we didn't talk about it, right? And that nobody did. And it's a cultural thing. It's come down through the churches and everything else. We just don't talk about it. So who is this woman out there talking about this issue? My goodness, I wish she'd be quiet. It's just, you know, dirty laundry in public places and all that stuff. But we did talk about it, and I haven't stopped talking. And I suspect when I die, you'll hear a little knock on the lid of the coffin, and I'll pop up going, and there's just one more thing. Because I'm determined that this should happen. So we started with White Balloon Day, which I hope you all get involved with. It's a national White Balloon Day. It's during National Child Protection Week, which is, of course, following Father's Day. It begins on Father's Day and goes for a week. So in September, first week in September. And it is an opportunity for every person in this country to go and source a white balloon, either through us or through the supermarket or newsagent, and tie it to your letterbox, to your front fence, to your pot plant at work, whatever, as a demonstration to the 1 in 5 people that are in your lives that you may or may not know. If it's on your letterbox, it's to the little kid that's riding his bike on his way to school, or to mum driving to school, or dad coming home from work, that this is an issue we are ready to talk about, that we need to break the silence on child sexual assault, because that's the first port of call to actually dealing with this. So Breaking the silence worked. It became a national event. It still is. And I'm asking you all to please get on our website at some point and really get involved in that. It's just so important. Breast cancer is important. Everything's important. Nothing is more important than our children. You all know that. That's why you're sitting in this room. So we have to try and... This is a terrible subject. It's a yucky subject, and people... It's much easier to do other things, terrible things that happen to children. I'm not suggesting for a moment that all the horrible ways that you could abuse a child aren't equally revolting, or even illnesses for children. But sexual assault seems to be... There's something there that people find very difficult to get engaged in. Please get a white balloon, because you've got to know that someone who needs to see it will see it. And in fact, if you think of five... You've all got five children in your lives. If you just think of those five children and you imagine that one of those will be sexually assaulted in some way before they turn 18, then you start to begin to understand how important this issue is. So we started White Balloon Day, and kids were speaking out. They were telling their teachers. And we went to the principals, two of them in Logan at the time in particular, rang me up and said, "Hedy, we'd really love to support this. We really, really would. And we know how necessary it is, but we can't. Because the kids will disclose, and we don't know what to do with that. There's no resources," and there wasn't. There was no counselling. There was no, there was nothing. Just this distressed child in the waiting room, So Braveheart started to provide counselling support, specialist child sexual assault counselling support. And that's how it's grown over the years. And then we've started with the education program. So we've got Ditto, Keep Safe Adventure. Does anyone in the room, has anyone seen Ditto? Oh, great, fantastic. Ditto's now visited over 600,000 children face to face, and oh, goodness knows how many through our programs. Fully funded in Tasmania, so we go into every school and daycare centre in Tasmania, and it goes like this. "My mouth and my chest are my private parts, between my legs and my bottom are. If anyone touches, I say, nah, they're my private parts." Thank you. Applause, please. It's not often I sing to 1,000 people, let me tell you. I can't sing to save myself. And the other one is a run and tell someone you can trust, okay? So what's happening is these kids are doing it. I'll tell you a little story, a little childcare centre. We go in with Ditto. This is a couple of years ago. It's just one that I always... That bing, that means 10 minutes, just by the way. I worked that out before. Smart. I am smart. So we go into this childcare centre, and Ditto does the performance, which is a 30-minute live performance. Ditto's a big, like, Humphrey B. Bear type character. The kids just love Ditto. It works a treat. We give the show, we go away, week goes by, we get a complaint from a mother. Mother comes into the childcare centre, says, "Little Johnny's touching these girls." Well, little Johnny is touching the girls. And she says, he didn't do that. Your Ditto taught him that. It's Ditto's fault." And we were like, "Oh, I don't think so." Because by then we'd seen a couple of 100,000 kids, and that had never happened before. So anyway, long story short, we worked through that with the childcare centre and the mother. Well, little Johnny was always touching the kids, but the kids didn't know it was wrong. And the kids didn't report it because they didn't think anything about it. But now we've taught them, right? Some of this is obviously just normal behaviour that young people engage in, that kids' behaviour. It's up to you to differentiate, which we can help you with as well now. But the kids now know, "My mouth and my chest and my private parts, between my legs and my bottom are. If anyone touches, I say, nah-uh, they're my private parts." So the kids were going, nah-uh. And the other song is, "Run and tell someone you can trust." So guess what they were doing? They were telling. So little Johnny had always been touching these kids inappropriately. The kids didn't think too much of it because they didn't really understand that it was wrong or anything much about it. And so now they did, and now they were telling, and so now that had come to the attention of the mother. That little Johnny and his little brother, who was only 18 months old, I think, were both being sexually assaulted by an uncle. These kids were just acting out, right? And that disclosure, like literally tens of thousands of others over the last probably about 15 years now, Ditto, would not have happened without this program. And it, you don't... Oh, it's a different subject. I was going to talk to you about penises and vaginas, but, maybe not. Maybe next time. The point of what I wanted to say is this, that you don't have to talk about penises and vaginas with the little tykes for them to understand the messages of personal safety. And that's the strongest point. We don't have objections to it either. But we know, but I'm talking to the teaching community particularly here, we know that some parents don't like it. And that's why we've got these amazing curriculums that are not mandatory. So what's happening? Our kids are missing out on this basic fundamental information which can be delivered without scaring the life out of everybody. Okay? It can be a lot of fun to teach kids about personal safety. So that's what we do. We do all our work under the three P's: educate our kids, empower adults with knowledge. We do lots of training right across the country in universities, TAFEs and whatnot around training adults how to recognise it, how to respond, and protect us around our legislative reform agenda. So making sure that the legal profession and the laws and the courts in the country start to understand the true dynamics of child sexual assault. I'm being rounded upon, just in case you haven't noticed, because I've talked too long, as usual. So I'll finish now, and I want to thank you all very much, wish you well. Thank you so much, each and every one of you, for your work with children. Very much appreciated. Thank you. Thank you.